All right, I'll turn it over to John.
Thank you, Father. Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for braving the weather. Thank you so much for your support and attendance over these past 3 weeks so far. It's our fourth week of our Lenten speaker series, so I'm so happy to have you out here. And this is one, as I've alluded to each and every week, that's near and dear to our heart. Again, we've been going from spiritual to practical. Last week we were a little spiritual, and now again we're gonna finish the program with somebody very practical. I'm so thrilled. This is an organization I just have the utmost respect for, and I know from talking to some of you in the room that you've the people that have had experience with these folks, it's been wonderful. And like you, I'm sure that you've also heard some misconceptions about what hospice does and what they can do and who should be in hospice. And so I am just so thrilled. They've asked me to be very brief on the introduction, which is so difficult for me to do. So I'll just say, again, we're going to try to hold to an hour, you know, Orthodox time and all. And right after this, the next couple weeks after Pascha, the Adult Ed Committee is going to start planning for next year. So if you have any ideas, please see me or Deacon Peter or Robin or anybody else on the committee with your ideas. So we're so looking forward to it. But again, thank you for your support. But with no further ado, we have two guests with us tonight from Hospice of Central PA. Their office is on Linglestown Road in Harrisburg, kind of near Front Street on that end of it. So they have an office building and they have a residence there. And they're one of several hospices in the area, but they're one of the main hospices that serve our area. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to, we have in the back, we have Beth Mehmet, the Development Director of Hospice of Central PA. And we have Jeannie McClintock, an LPN with Hospice of Central PA. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you very much. I love this microphone. I feel like a crooner.
Yeah. You know?
I should have worn blue suede shoes or something, you know? This is so cool. Anyway, thank you for having me. This is my 44th year of nursing. I started when I was 12. And actually, this is my 15th year as a certified hospice and palliative care nurse. And you know, it took me a while to find my niche, but I have to tell you that this hospice and palliative care is my passion. It is my calling. It is what I feel like I need to be doing. But I have been a field nurse for many, many moons, and of late, when my husband retired, I knew I didn't want to retire then. For reasons, if anybody has a retired husband at home, they understand that I will keep working and I will have my walker and I will be about 85. And yeah, no. So anyway, I wrote a proposal because I felt that there is such a misconception about hospice. When people hear the H word, right? People look at me like I'm the Grim Reaper. You know, that is not the case. I left it in the car, my costume. So, no, hospice isn't about that. If you take anything away from my talk tonight, take away this. Hospice is not about dying. It is about the journey of living until we do die. How nice would it be if we had a team of people that supported us every day? Had your own nurse, your own social worker when you were mad at your husband to work those things out. Your own hospice aide who might read the Bible to you or make sure that your fingernails were painted and talk to you about life and your legacy and, you know, just how neat it would be. And have your own, of course, hospice physician, hospice and palliative care. We'll talk a little bit about palliative care later on, but I want to focus on hospice at first, okay? So what is hospice? First of all, it is not about just death, okay? It is a philosophy of care, okay? A philosophy of care. And it's supported by a specialized branch of medicine. Our mission at Hospice of Central Pennsylvania should be the mission of every hospice, and that is to provide the highest quality of physical, emotional, and spiritual support with dignity and respect. That's what it should be, and that's what I feel that my peers do every day. I can't tell you about, you know, what particular faith family my staff, our staff belongs to. I can tell you this, they're the most spiritual people that you've ever met. And so when I wrote the proposal, I really thought that it was important that people learn that the H word is more than just about dying. So I wrote a proposal for community education, and so that's what I was given. And so I believe it's now my calling to get out there and be kind of the hospice evangelist, you know, and talk about end of life, which nobody wants to talk about, right? Okay. Our vision, which should be any hospice's vision, is continue to be a community that embraces specialized end-of-life care with the same importance as the beginning of life. Now, personally, I've done a lot of things in my nursing career, and my least favorite was maternity. You know, all those whiny women threatening to strangle their husbands was not my kind of nursing. So, anyway, I'm glad that I found my niche at this end of things. But I have to tell you that hospice nursing is, to me, old-fashioned nursing. Back when I started in the Stone Age in the early 70s, we actually had to give back rubs on night shift. Does anybody remember those times? Nurses on the 3 to 11 shift or night shift, when those fluorescent lights were down, we met with our patients individually, offered them a back rub, but it was the time that you sat with your patient and you got to talk to them. Instead of, okay, give me your arm, I'm taking a tube of blood, or this is what your pre-op orders are, or whatever. It was that time when you connected with your patient. My daughter's also a nurse, and she has a master's in nursing. And she did critical care for about 7 years before she went back and got her master's. She doesn't understand how I can do hospice nursing, and I don't understand how she can do critical care. She says this, you know, most of her patients are intubated. So when they're extubated and they actually talk, they're shifted out of there, you know. So there's no real engaging other than doing the clinical things necessary. For me, that's not my nursing. My nursing is to be able to connect with my patients and their families. That is the core of hospice right there, is that what other branch of medicine focuses on not only the patient, but their family and the people that love them, their caregivers, you know, and that's what is so amazing about it. You get to learn people's stories. You get to reinforce to the patient and the family what their legacy is. We engage in what we call life review, you know, enabling that patient to talk about the things that gave them great pride and maybe the things that they regretted. You know, it's a time to kind of, you know, take stock of things. It's work, and work has to be done before that patient can find peace at the end of their life. And that is our ultimate goal, is to help the person and the family find that peace at the end of their life. So what does hospice do? Hospice helps patients and families deal with advanced terminal illnesses. We're the people that go in and talk to the patient and the family when the doctor has said, I'm sorry, there's nothing more that can be done for you. We've come a long way in this discussion. You know, we've met a lot of roadblocks with physicians sometimes because physicians want to cure. They want to do that. They take that Hippocratic oath very seriously. Do no harm. And, you know, and sometimes they're reluctant to have that end-of-life discussion. You know, but it is part of living, you know? And what is happening, and you're seeing this now, how many of you, mostly you're younger than I am, but remember having only one doctor, you know? Yay! growing up in the early 50s, we had one doctor, and that doctor took care of my mom, my dad, my grandma, my grandpa, my brothers. So having only one doctor allowed that physician to know the good and the bad and the ugly about your family, right? Not just the physical history, but the emotional history, the spiritual history. Okay, how many of you have one doctor today? One person!
He just retired.
Oh, no.
Last week.
Oh, no! Oh, no! And
he delivered my children and their doctor. And yeah, he just retired.
Well, yeah, and he was old school, wasn't he?
Yeah.
There isn't too much of that anymore. You know, and in fact, if you go into a hospital now, your doctor doesn't follow you. The hospitalist follows you. And the hospitalists are on rotation. So God forbid you come in on a Sunday, and they see you on Sunday, and you've given them the whole story, and you saw them on Monday, and then on Tuesday they rotate, and the new doctor comes in. My point in telling you all this is there's not that physician-patient connection so much anymore. We have so many hands in the pot, right? So a congestive heart failure patient may have a cardiologist, may have a pulmonologist if they're having difficulty breathing. They have their family physician that gives them their flu shots. They may have the CHF clinic involved in their care as they come toward end of life when their kidneys start to decline. Now you have a renal doctor involved in the care. And in a perfect world, they all talk to each other, don't they? In a perfect world, right? The point of all this is that when it comes down to end of life, and you have so many people involved in the care, and you have the cardiologist that's putting the Band-Aid on the heart, and the renal doctor that's putting the Band-Aid on the kidneys, and the pulmonologist doing the same thing for the lungs. And when it comes down to that, and I'll use CHF as an example, because my father passed away from CHF, and I certainly cared for a lot of patients with that disease. The thing is that when it came down, all those pills helped pull that water out of his system, you know, pull that fluid to keep his breathing and the edema down in his legs. When it came down to it and his kidneys were shot, they said to him, "Do you want dialysis?" And for those of you who don't know what dialysis is, it's an artificial kidney, basically. You're hooked up to a machine, your blood is pulled from your body. Now that's hemodialysis. Pulled from the body, recirculated, all the toxins are removed, and it's put back in. But you're looking at 2-3 days a week, 6 to 8 hours attached to a machine. To my dad, and I can only speak for my father, that to him was not quality of life. And you're going to hear that term throughout what I talk about, because quality of life is really important. And to my dad, he wanted nature to progress. He did not want dialysis. His wish was to die at home, and he was granted that wish sitting in the sunshine on his back porch in South Carolina with a book in his lap when he passed, completely at peace. Again, that's our goal, completely at peace. And so, anyway, back to what hospice does. The focus is quality of life rather than cure. The goal is to support the patient and the loved ones to live each day as fully as possible with the highest quality of care possible. And the care is provided in the place that you call home. So what's home? You know, I took care of somebody under the State Street Bridge one time in a shopping cart. Had a little shopping cart under the State Street Bridge. Now, fortunately, we were able to place him, you know, at Spring Creek pretty quickly after that. But my first visit was to the shopping cart under the State Street Bridge. So, but that was his home. I have been in mansions, and I have been in condemned buildings, and I have been in trailers. I remember I saw a patient up in rural Perry County. It says 1.5 miles up gravel road, 2 trailers on property. His is the nicest. So as my car is bottoming out, going up there, there are these 2 trailers. And I thought they'd be, you know, like this. And instead, they were one here and one here. And I stood between them and I looked to see which one was nicer. And the nicer one had a cinder block that was turned on its edge and a dog barking inside. And I said, this is the nicer one. I remember throwing my bag in and crawling in on my hands and knees. And as it turned out, this curmudgeon of a man was a hermit. He had cut off his family. He had COPD. And he had had very minimal involvement. He was given a six-month diagnosis. We had him for 2.5 years. He had a blast. He was on hospice. He loved the interaction. You know, the nurse that saw him regularly brought treats for his dog. I mean, it was amazing. He wasn't going. He was declining. Now, a patient can be on hospice longer than 6 months, but they have to present a decline. And I will tell you that every time it got close to his discharge, he suddenly took a turn. You know, but anyway, so, you know, I have had that privilege of you serve people wherever, you know, wherever it's home. So I want to share the history of hospice. I don't know about you, but I love history. I love how did things start, you know? Well, hospice. First of all, the word hospice comes from the word hospitality. So back in medieval times, it wasn't uncommon for hospices or places of hospitality to be the places like convents and monasteries where the sick, the infirmed, the dying, the lonely would go for support. So the woman who came up with the idea of hospice used that term to relate that it should be a place where someone feels safe and that they can come and find peace. Dame Cicely Saunders was the founder of hospice, an amazing woman. She died in 2005 at the age of 87, but she was the mother of the modern hospice unit. An amazing lady. She was born to a wealthy family. And she was involved in different organizations through philanthropy, through her family, and she really began to see how people at end of life were treated. And so she became an almoner. I had never heard that term before. And what it is was a social worker. Alms for the poor. An almoner was a social worker back, way back when. She was horrified about the conditions for patients at end of life. And as a social worker, she really attempted to make some changes within the hospital system. And it didn't work. So she went back to school and became a nurse. And as a nurse, she felt that she could make these changes. She wasn't able to. And she went back and she became a physician. And as a physician, she was finally able to take charge of things, and she formed the first hospice. It was St. Christopher's Hospice, located in London, in a suburb of London. And she applied that word hospice to the care of the dying. The thing that was so neat about her, well, many, many things. First of all, I like the fact that she was 6 feet tall. Which, you know, I mean, think, you know, back then it was pretty amazing. But anyway, she was the first to coin the term total pain. Now, what she meant by that, and we still use this today in hospice, is she recognized that a person wasn't their physical pain. It was their emotional and that spiritual pain that makes a person who we are. And so, therefore, at end of life, you not only have to treat and find peace with the physical pain, you have to find peace with the spiritual and the emotional pain as well. And to this day, that has carried over. We focus in hospice today on not just the physical. Although we're trained in that, and we treat pain and symptoms very aggressively in hospice, but we also focus on the spiritual and the emotional. I'll give you an example of the spiritual. I can can remember this as if it was yesterday. I had a patient by the name of George. He was in his late 80s, and he was dying of advanced lung cancer, end-stage lung cancer. And he, I had gotten him a hospital bed. He wouldn't get in it. He preferred to stay in his recliner, his lazy boy. And he was clearly, as far as clinical symptoms, very end of life. He was exhibiting symptoms of apnea, absence of breathing, lasting 40, 50 seconds, and then a gasp for air. And as well as the mottling, you know, where the circulation slows and the skin begins to mottle and become cold. He was all that. And I thought to myself, you know, he didn't appear to be at peace. He was restless, and he just seemed like there was something just holding him. And I remember I got down next to him in the lazy boy, next to him, next to his chair, and I took his hand and I said to him, George, is there anything that I can help you with? Are you in pain? He shook his head, no. I said, what about your breathing? And clearly his breathing was labored, of course, but nope, shook his head. I said, George, is there anything that I can help you with? And he said, Jeannie, God's not going to take me. You know, and as a Christian myself, that's a pretty hard thing to hear, you know? And so what I did immediately was I called our chaplain. Our chaplains are specifically trained in end-of-life issues. This gentleman was in such spiritual pain that he wasn't going to die. He was clinging onto life as hard as he possibly could. This man was Catholic. I immediately called his priest, who came immediately. They sat and talked to him. And what it was he was a bombardier in World War II. He had bombed a troop train. He carried that with him for 60-some years. And he truly believed that God wasn't going to take him home. You know, our chaplain and the priest met with him, and he passed within 30 minutes completely at peace. He took his breath with his peaceful look on his face and let go. That's spiritual pain. That's a pretty graphic example of spiritual pain. Emotional pain, very real. Who's going to take care of my wife? Who's going to take care of my husband? Is anybody going to remember me? You know, was my life a good life? You know, am I going to heaven or am I going to hell? These are all things that people think about at the end of life. And it can be consciously or subconsciously. It's there. You know, terminal agitation, as we call it in the medical community, is difficult to see. You see that agitation, you see that restlessness, and you just want to help. And sure, there's anti-anxiety medications that we can give, but our goal is to really have that patient truly find that peace at the end of life. I had a patient that was actively dying at Community General, and this was years ago, and we do something called general inpatient hospice. And what it is a specific payment set up under Medicare where patients may go to the hospital for symptoms not controlled, for, you know, like acute pain, that type of thing. Well, this patient came into the hospital and it was deemed that she was actively dying and it would be too difficult to transfer her anywhere else to provide care, figuring she might die in the ambulance on the way home. So she was put on general inpatient hospice. Well, when we were on day 5 and she still hadn't passed, the physicians were like, what is holding her to this earth? And her husband came in every day and sat vigil with her from the time that visiting hours started until the time it stopped. And he would sit with her, and she wasn't letting go. She had no nutrition, nothing. The only small bit of hydration she was getting was enough to give her the morphine, and that was it. So I was baffled. And then she wasn't in pain, but there was a restlessness about her. And I finally said to her husband, "Do you think there's anything that's holding her here, that's preventing her from transitioning?" And he started to cry. And he said, "I know what it is." And I said, "Well, whatever it is, if you think it will bring her peace, why don't you do it?" And he said, "Okay, but will you stay in the room with me?" And I said, I'll stay in the room. I'll do whatever you want me to do." So he went in, and he took her name, her hand, and her name was Violet. And he said, "Violet, I beg your forgiveness." And he sobbed. And he said, "I hurt you, and I have carried that hurt with me, and my hurt that I had caused you. And I know we never resolved this, but I beg your forgiveness. I'm sorry for what I did to hurt you, and I hope that you'll find it in you to forgive me." Well, I was a mess. I'm behind the curtain going. Anyway, so I heard her. I didn't hear her say anything, of course. She was totally unconscious. But two tears just started streaming down the sides of her face, and she was in the hospital bed. And she took a breath and passed. And what it was that in the early 1950s, he was working, and he had an affair with his secretary. It was short-lived, but at that time, they had four children they were raising. So you can imagine having four children in the 50s where she didn't work, and her husband went off to work, and she was involved in caring for these four kids. And so they pushed it down. They just pushed it down, and it remained the elephant in the room for so long that, but it was always there. And he loved her, and she loved him, and they went on with their life. But it was there. And, you know, it held her to this earth. And when he asked her forgiveness, she gave it. And she passed completely at peace. That's pretty graphic example of emotional pain. And, you know, I will always remember that was the thing that held her down to this earth. I mean, you will see that there are patients that have amazing ability to cling to life, you know, like try to get past an anniversary or a Christmas or, you know, some kind of significant holiday. It is amazing sometimes, you know, that will to live. I'm going backward and I apologize. There's a wonderful quote from Dame Cicely Saunders I want to share with you. It says, "You matter because you are you, and you matter until the end of your life. We will do all that we can to help you die peacefully, but also to live until you die." That pretty much sums up what hospice does and what we are. Let me go back a little bit and give you the history of how it wound up here in the United States. Dame Cicely Saunders established the first hospice at St. Christopher's in London. And then in 1963, she came to the United States and she presented at Yale. And she referred to it as holistic hospice. That lecture launched a whole chain of events. Right about that time, Dr. Kubler-Ross, are you familiar with her? On Death and Dying, she wrote the book, became a bestseller. And she was a great advocate for end-of-life care as well. So here you have Cicely Saunders coming from London, and then Kubler-Ross coming out with her book. She testified before the Senate on end-of-life care. She was the one that talked about the stages of dying, the stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Right toward the end of her life, I just want to add this like little footnote, it's that she had to make a point of telling people that you don't experience these stages in order. you know, that everybody is different, and some people will experience one thing and others will not, because people were so set in stone, they were almost like it was a checklist, you know, that they were going down, and it wasn't meant to be that. So she did want that clarified before she died. Anyway, Florence Ward Wald, she was the dean of Yale Nursing School. She heard Dame Cicely Saunders speak at Yale, and it was the impact of that speech plus Kubler-Ross led her and two others, a pediatrician and a nurse, and I guess there was another social worker in there too, who founded the Connecticut Hospice. It was in Branford, Connecticut, and was in 1974. So, 1979, Hospice of Central Pennsylvania, which I'm very proud to represent, became one of the first hospice programs in the nation. It's also one of the first to become a Medicare-certified hospice in the late 1980s. And Congress created the Medicare hospice benefit in 1982. They recognized finally that end-of-life care is important. But it was a battle. It wasn't until 1993, President Clinton assured that it was an accepted part of the healthcare continuum. In 2004, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation made a generous grant to the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, which the goal is to advance the understanding of end-of-life care. And we're just beginning to chip away at that. And that's why I'm so proud that Hospice of Central Pennsylvania allowed me to take the role of the community health educator and present on what hospice is. In 2010, this is really neat, and I'm very proud to be part of it, is that NHCPO, the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, partnered with the Veterans Administration, recognizing the needs of the veterans at end of life. Veterans from World War II are now dying on an average of 4,000 per day. But what we are seeing more than that, well, of course, we're seeing Korean veterans, but Vietnam vets, you know, their exposure to Agent Orange. And what's really come to the forefront, because World War II vets were told not to talk about their experiences. And my dad was a prisoner of war in World War II. He was shot down over Austria. He was a navigator and spent 11 months in a German prison camp. Never talked about his experiences, although it haunted him all his life. You know, he shattered several vertebrae in his back when his parachute caught in a tree and he plummeted to the ground. He never got care, so that back pain and those flashbacks and nightmares followed him all his life. However, I will tell you that my parents retired to South Carolina, right on the Atlanta or the Georgia border, and he, at the end of his life, in his 80s, was part of the PTSD study, and he was so proud of being part of that study that he actually began to talk about his experiences. And yeah, so that was major. But toward the end of his life, you know, he had periods of confusion, and he was back in his B-17, you know, and he would look up and he'd say, "You look like my daughter. You got to get out of here," you know. But yeah, but anyway, this partnership, it's called the We Honor Veterans Partnership, and I'm the chair of that of the organization at Hospice of Central Pennsylvania, and we work with the Lebanon VA, and it's a wonderful partnership. Our purpose is honor and recognition, and for the Vietnam vet, that's a big deal. As someone who is from that Vietnam era, you know, the fact that they were ostracized when they came home from that war, to recognize their service, and we give them a pin and a certificate. What we started to do just recently, it had been our social workers and nurses that presented the pin, but now we have graduated so many vet-to-vet volunteers, which is part of the We Honor Vet program, that our vet-to-vet volunteers now present the pins and certificates. And what a difference that's making, to be recognized by a fellow vet, you know. So honor and recognition, education is the other thing. We are learning about taking care of patients with soul injuries. Think about that. You know, things that people have seen on the battlefield that, you know, that are in their nightmares every night, and caring for them and their soul injuries, which really surface toward end of life. So we're learning a lot, we're educating ourselves, we're educating the community on veterans at end of life. So we're really, really proud of that. So who provides hospice care? It's an interdisciplinary team. And, you know, having been a nurse in different fields, it was always like, yeah, an interdisciplinary team. Yeah, that'll be the day. Well, I have to tell you, it really exists. It really does. You know, every patient is part of a team. Now, we're a little creative at HCP. We have the butterfly team, the dragonfly team, the, you know, they're really into birds and bugs. Anyway, but so the teams, they meet every 2 weeks, and they have an interdisciplinary team meeting. People at the table are the nurses, the social workers, the hospice aides, the volunteer coordinators, our physicians. We sit down and we discuss the patient, or chaplains are there too, every aspect, physical, emotional, spiritual. How can we address the patient's needs to the best of our ability? I will tell you my theory. There is no such thing as a functional family. I have learned this. And if you think your family's functional, you're delusional. Anyway, I have learned that. But anyway, we do try to focus. There are things we can't fix in families. But we hope that we can find a level of peace for them as well. So we have the doctors, the nurses, the social workers, the hospice aides. We also provide, and this is really important, these are people on our services, is we have palliative certified massage therapists. And end-of-life massage is not just for the patient, but it's for the family member as well. And a bonus if you work for HCP is that... Well, there's a massage schedule for the staff that we can sign up once a month, too, which is bonus. But anyway, and music therapy, wonderful, wonderful. Harpists, guitarists, they're incredible. When my mom passed a year ago on hospice, the music therapist came, and I had never met this particular music therapist before, and she said to me, and my mom was real restless. She died of Alzheimer's disease, and the music therapist asked me, what kind of music did your mother like? And I said, Broadway musicals, Broadway tunes. And so she started with Edelweiss from The Sound of Music. And my mom, who was restless and, you know, thrashing around, completely calm. It was just amazing. And she just went into a whole melody of different Broadway tunes. The other thing I do have to tell you is that our massage or our music therapist gave us a training one time. And what they said is toward the very transition at end of life, you know, when the patient has got kind of one foot in this life and one in the next, they play chords rather than recognizable tunes. Something that would pull them back and attach music to a memory. Isn't that interesting? So they're just soothing chords that help the patient transition. It's just, it's wonderful that they do that, and they know that. So, any questions? Because obviously you know I'm passionate about this, and I'll just keep on going until you tell me to shut up. So,
how,
yes?
How do you work the team? Is there one team for each patient?
Yes. The teams are geographical.
Okay.
So our chickadee team is in the Pottsville area. And, you know, our butterfly team serves the nursing homes and assisted livings. And then we have, you know, the team on the West Shore and then the team that serves Upper Dauphin County. And we cover 8 counties. So we do really try hard to make it geographical. Now, one thing about HCP, and if you ever have to look for hospices, of course we're the best. But I will tell you this. Our on-call staff, our evening staff, they're not on-call nurses. Do you know what I mean? I worked for another hospice, and I had to do an on-call rotation. So if I was on call a weekend, that meant that somebody else had to see my patients during the week to cover those 2 days that I was off. HCP's not set up that way. We have fully staffed afternoon shift, fully staffed night shift, fully staffed weekend shifts, and holidays. So, you know, it's not like you get some grumpy nurse that's, you know, already worked. And there were times I was grumpy, I'm sorry. But, you know, when I worked a full day and then I was on call overnight, you know. But so we don't have that, which is really neat. We're completely staffed 24/7. Did I answer your question? I hope.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it was arranged so that the patient would be pretty much seeing the same.
Yes, people. That is our goal. That is our absolute goal. Of course, nurses do go on vacation, darn them. And, you know, so, yeah, it will happen that you'll see a different nurse. But our goal is really that continuity of care, that we really feel the bond should develop, you know. So, yes?
You know, you'll see promotions sometimes for hospice care provided by different like homes, you know, like
yes.
You know, assisted living communities or things like that.
Uh-huh.
Is that true hospice care that you're seeing there, or is that something separate?
That's a very good question. Actually, we do provide care in assisted livings, personal care homes, and nursing homes. And this is something that HCP, we're very, very aware of, that we must not be a redundancy of care. Does that make sense? Because that patient is paying for that bed in the nursing home or assisted living. Our care comes as a specialized care. Even our aides have sat for boards in hospice and palliative care. So our focus is to partner with that institution so that, you know, we either will give the bath or we will come in and feed, or we will take that patient in their wheelchair for a walk on the grounds. So we are not taking away from what they're paid to do. Does that make sense? And we're very, very cautious of that. And we have contracts with pretty much every facility, from Shippensburg, Chambersburg, all the way up through Pottsville. And but there are, I just need to make you aware that there are some nursing homes that own hospices. So they have to walk a very, very fine line because Medicare is looking at that. You know, it is not to be redundant care. It is to be a specialized care which we give to our hospice patients. Yes, John?
You talked about palliative care.
Yes.
And I hear a lot of, I think that circles around some of the things that hospice people have misconceptions.
Yes.
Can you explain what palliative care is and what it isn't?
Oh, I'll be glad to do that.
You know, I always hear that hospice hastens death, which just irks me.
Yes, that is certainly one of the myths, you know. I hear it, you know, if that nurse hadn't come in and give mom morphine, she sped things up. No. You know, we are always balancing disease progression against the titration of the medication. And, you know, I'll kind of get into that. In fact, palliative care, if you don't mind if I shelve it for a little bit, for a bit. Yes?
Well, I think we had that conversation last week, and it goes into the whole thing about palliative care and the concept of hastening death.
Yes.
And this might be off track of what you were going to say.
No.
My big challenge in working with people who I know are at end of life, but they're still seeing their oncologist, they're still going through chemo, even though the chemo, you know, is not helping. They're still doing things. They don't want to give up, but as you had mentioned, the doctor doesn't want to give up either.
Yeah.
And so if the doctor's not going to give up, then how do you get to the patient?
Oh, this is so timely. I'm so excited to talk about this. You are absolutely right. This is one of my biggest frustrations, you know? And there are certain physicians, I'm not telling you names, that don't believe in hospice at all. Yep. You know, that's completely out. What we are piloting, and I'm going to get all scrambled up here, but we have this amazing palliative program. We saw the handwriting on the wall years ago that too many patients were being referred to hospice. In fact, the average length of stay, I think, is 15 days now, 12 to 15 days. That's average length of stay. So think about that. Some people are dying in the ambulance on the way home. So it's not meant to be that. It's meant to be at least a six-month benefit. So, and I'm jumping ahead, but this, I want to make this point so I don't forget. About 2.5 years ago, the federal government, Medicare, I know this is hard to believe, but think 2.5 years back, okay, said that they would like to offer a pilot program. And it was called the Medicare Care Choices Model, the MCCM, okay? And they sent out 2,000 applications within the United States. And out of those 2,000 applications, we were one of them, Hospice of Central Pennsylvania. We filled out the program to run the pilot program called the MCCM. 140 contracts were awarded in the nation. We got it. We got one of them, which is pretty cool. So what we rolled out, and I think, Beth, has it been about 2.5 years now? Is we were able to, and this is how Medicare set it up, we were able to offer to patients with 4 illnesses. Now, this is Medicare. You got to understand that, okay? An opportunity to have treatment until death. What a novel idea, because under hospice, you have to give up any treatment for a cure. So what this did is allowed patients, like patients who wanted to continue dialysis, for example, or blood transfusions, or chemo, or whatever, to maintain hospice, go on to the MCCM program until death. So we rolled it out 2.5 years ago. It has been really successful. Now, here's the 4 diseases, okay? Congestive heart failure. COPD, advanced stage cancers, and HIV/AIDS, okay? Those are the only 4 diseases. But when you consider that advanced stage cancers and COPD and CHF are really, you know, one of the primary diseases that, you know, we deal with, doesn't include dementias, okay? But it's a start. Well, we're really showing, and there's so much paperwork involved and so many statistics involved and data that's being accumulated, that our hope is that the pilot program was only 4 years or 5? Those 3 years. And so that means we're coming kind of to the end of it. That the hope is that the program will open up more. But I don't know now. You know, I don't know. what will happen. But it has worked. It has allowed patients to not give up, you know, the choice of continuing their care. So anyway, we are really proud to be part of the MCCM program. And when we took on the MCCM, what we also did is we decided we would look at breaking off from hospice. Okay, if you picture Hospice of Central Pennsylvania as the big umbrella, under that, Levos Palliative Solutions was born. Okay, and so we have a team that we under Levos that has a nurse navigator. We have so the nurse would get the referral maybe for the MCCM, and we're taking on some other palliative care. Palliative means to like mitigate, no cure necessarily. It's exactly. Walk in that journey with the patient who has the chronic illness. And so the MCCM and the palliative care solutions, we're really proud of that it's kind of come together. And it kind of takes a hit financially sometimes, you know, to provide, you know, a social worker, maybe if the patient has some psychosocial needs or the family does, and the nurse. But we're really committed to doing that. So, yes?
So the MCCM, a person qualifies for that if they have one of those four diseases?
Yes.
What else does it qualify?
Everything else that hospice says. You know, a terminal diagnosis still, you know, with life expectancy measured in months, not years, 6 months or less, that is the same. The only difference is that the patient can opt for treatment for as long as they would like, up until death.
Okay.
For that specific disease.
For those four diseases. Yes.
How do they interact with the oncologist or the cardiologist? I mean, I would think that
it's
very
educating.
Quickly they realize, you know, I really need to just stop treatment. Do you have statistics on that? Like what they...
Oh, good. I didn't know if I could talk about that. So feel free to talk about it. Cause
we just started a partnership with Anderson Hotel. We're offering palliative service in their office. It's literally started on March 8th.
Yes. Oh, good. We can't talk about it then.
This deal is gathering that data so we can look and see, does it mean they transition to hospice earlier? Does it... physicians refer early and which don't. So we have a lot of data. Our industry's driven on data. Our CEO loves data.
I hate data.
We're looking at those numbers very carefully. We're sharing them not just internally, but we're sharing them now with this physician group.
Right.
And we're looking to share with other physician groups something they need to do for their reimbursements as well.
Well, I guess what I was going to say, it's kind of a cop-out for the physicians because, you know, at a certain point, if they're taking care of their patients the way they need to be taking care of them, they need to be saying, you know, I have a specific example of a patient whose doctor told them, he had been going through treatment, was in a little bit of a remission for went back into for like 3 years. And when he came back and he had a scan, went into the doctor's straight doc, and the doc said, "I don't see you with me to see the new year." And then the guy was like, "Okay, what can we do?" And instead of the doctor saying, "I think this is the time for you," it's 3 years. It was 3 weeks until New Year. 3 weeks.
And I think that's very what we need to know.
But the doctor didn't. And then he went in a week later to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Oh, you look too good to be in hospice."
Oh, I can tell a lot of those kind of stories.
It's so frustrating.
It is. And that's why I believe is 12 to 15 days.
And people are like, oh, I love hospice. My mother was in hospice, and she was in hospice for 7 days.
And you know what? The thing that we hear, you have a great point. The thing we hear back when we send out the survey after the patient has died is from the families. Almost everyone is, I wish we would have heard about hospice sooner. But I'm really thinking positively. This partnership with Anderson Patel is a beginning. This is a beginning that those doctors don't have to say, I'm sorry. But they can say, listen, I would like you to talk to a palliative certified physician. And our doctors are going to go to their office and see those patients. To take that pressure off of those oncologists, to me, it's a wonderful partnership. But it's a drop in the ocean, you know? The next is congestive heart failure clinics and other oncology offices. Yes?
What you need to do is get your physician a copy of Being Mortal.
Great book. Oh, what a wonderful book.
What a great book. Like that, and have them read it.
Yes.
Because it's not coming from a layperson.
Yeah.
Or a hospice volunteer or a nurse, right?
Yes.
It's coming from a fellow physician.
Yes.
It
would.
Basically saying the same things that you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. The book is phenomenal. But that is why that I felt it was so important to have community education. Hey, I'm going to flip-flop around because I got the...
Yeah. Can you share a little bit about... we dealt with hospice before, but too many. And they've been great experiences. But could you share a little bit about how... The people of hospice, the team, deals with the family.
Oh,
because
yes.
Because I just felt that was
Well, once again, it's that interdisciplinary team. You know, everybody's on the same page. You know, and the goal is for that patient to find peace and the family, too, to feel supported. But, you know, the eyes and ears of our hospice aide are just as important. In fact, more so, because they're in there 3 to 5 days a week. They're the ones that will tell us, you know what, George hasn't eaten. He's talking to people that aren't there. You know, these kind of things we need to know, and that is part of that team that surrounds the patient and surrounds the family. And, you know, it's talking the family into when, at end of life when they go, George, if you would just take 2 more bites of yogurt, please. I know he'll get better, even if 2 bites. And then having that conversation, and believe me, I've had that conversation at a kitchen table, and I've had that conversation in a doctor's office and in a hospital to nurses, you know, to understand that when the patient transitions, you know, at end of life, nutrition is something that the patient doesn't need anymore, you know, and if you force it, it becomes a detriment. And, you know, that's a difficult thing, especially for a loved one to hear, because we are that nurturing, you know, culture of chicken soup and all that. Let me just go fast, and I apologize. I'm going back to hospice, and then I'll flip to palliative care, and then I'll open for questions. So I told you, when is it time for hospice? Patient has a terminal diagnosis, life expectancy of 6 months or less. Do we kick people off hospice after 6 months? No. As long as they present a decline, and that is certified by our family, our certified hospice and physicians, they continue. And when the patient comes out into hospice, it must be our doctor, you know, our medical doctor, and partnership with the patient's doctor that certifies the terminal diagnosis. Now, if a physician chooses not to see that patient or the patient chooses not to have their own doctor involved, then our medical director will take over. Okay? Who pays for hospice? Medicare sets the tone for payment. Medicaid follows other insurance companies' model, the setup for care. I think reimbursement is what, 140 a day. Now think about that. Average length of stay is 12 to 15 days. We're only getting paid $140 a day. We provide all the durable medical equipment. That's a hospital bed, overbed table, wheelchair, or a walker if they need it, bedside commode. That's why we're a nonprofit. And if you can figure out how the for-profits are doing it, let me know. Anyway, now that is it. That's just the durable medical equipment. That's the oxygen they need or whatever. In addition to that, we pay for all the medications. Then in addition to that, all the professional services, your nurse, your social worker, your chaplain, your physician, all that is coming out of that $140 a day. So you got a patient who's dying in the ambulance on the way home. That room is set up when that patient comes home. So that means the bed, everything's set up for that patient, and the patient dies. So it doesn't put us in the black. You know, so our goal is not money. Our goal is patient-centered care. Yes?
Well, I think that part of it is that there's the setup. You have the setup.
Yes.
And once that happens, and that's why it's so challenging, because it's the average is 12 to 15.
You're not recouping that. You're not. You're just not. Right, right. But the important thing, too, exactly. But here's an important thing to remember. Because we are a non-for-profit, completely non-for-profit, that we fundraise a lot. So you will see, I'll let Beth give her three-word spiel. Is that what you're going to do on that? But we fundraise, and, you know, so it allows us to not cherry pick our patients. A lot of hospices will only take Medicare. You know, we don't do that. Anybody that needs care, we will take. You know, we will never turn anybody away. Quick story. I mean, I worked for another hospice. I had a patient with bone pain. I wanted to get a low air loss mattress. These are the coolest mattresses in the world. They don't have sheets. The patient floats on them. You know, it's just amazing. And he was having such pain, and I was told no. He didn't meet criteria, because criteria for Medicare is the skin already has to be broken down. And his skin wasn't broken down yet. Anyway, but... So anyway, I came over to HCP, and I've been with them 6 years, and I had a similar situation, a lot of pain, patient was really emaciated, I wanted to get him a low air loss mattress. So I said to HCP, I said, I know it doesn't meet criteria. And they said, well, you just shut up. It's quality of life. And of course we're going to provide that. And I thought, I'm at the right place. That's a really big difference. So, okay. So anyway, so who pays for it? We get generous donations from our community to allow us to, to give care. What are the conditions? Is any terminal diagnosis? Because one of the myths is that it's only cancers or any. You know, we have ALS patients, you name it, we will take care of them. So, our services, pain and symptom management, emotional and spiritual support, we do palliative care, we do durable medical equipment, we do the medications. Patients do not pay for any ancillary services, massage, music therapy, pet therapy, all covered. Now, we are paid up to date of death. So, we are required by Medicare to provide bereavement supports to the patient. This sets us apart team as well, our hospice, because we have a bereavement team that is not contracted. They are ours. They are on staff. And our bereavement team sees the patient or the patient's family, serves the patient's family for a minimum of 13 months, more if they need it. We have a comprehensive bereavement team, newsletters, phone calls, support groups, education programs, Camp Dragonfly, which is a camp for grieving children between the ages of 6 and 15. This is my 17th year that I'll be doing Camp Dragonfly. It is an amazing thing to see these children, and the children are not from necessarily from our hospice. We get the referrals from our school systems. So these kids are coming where mom died from a domestic violence situation, dad died of suicide, it's been a murder, you know, we've seen it all. Grandma died, grandpa died, whatever. These kids come with the common denominator is grief. And so we focus on that, and we serve about 30 to 40 kids at two camps in the summer. One is at Camp Swatera in Bethel, and the other is Camp Hebron in Halifax. Yes? Actually, the Caring Place, which is owned by Highmark, is a wonderful partner of ours and sends a lot of their kids to our camp. And we, in turn, use the Caring Place. So it's a great partnership. But, yes? Absolutely, yes, absolutely. To the camp as well. Now, they set the tone for it, but actually, and I can't give you the specific date, but within the last couple of years, they actually, Medicaid did actually something that was really cool. We were doing very little hospice care for children, because the whole goal is they will treat until the last second. So they weren't getting the hospice supports that are needed. But thank God they finally changed the law and that children can have hospice supports and receive treatment. So, you know, finally, something progressive. So that has been good, and we are seeing more children now coming onto hospice. So, all right. Okay. What sets HCP apart from other agencies? I got to tell you this. Non-for-profit. We have the only agency in the area that has the gold seal of approval from Joint Commission. Be careful what you wish for. Boy, having Joint Commission come in. But anyway, we're very proud of that. We have full-time physicians and staff that are certified in hospice and palliative care. I had to sit for boards. Carolyn's House. Maybe you've heard of Carolyn's House. It's on Lingelstown Road. It is the only hospice residence in this area. It is a licensed personal care home. It's a real home-like setting. We use it for patients whose caregivers are kind of crashing and burning and need that extra support at end of life, or they're very close to dying. We also look at payment. Yes, there's a payment per day. However, we don't turn anybody away, and we do really significant pro bono for Carolyn's House. Told you about the MCCM. We on our vets program I told you about. Our journey program is our bereavement program. And then, of course, the Learning for Life program, which is what I do, the community education. And I have a whole list of topics that I cover for free. And then Camp Dragonfly. Okay, palliative care. The word palliate is defined as to relieve or lessen, okay? It is a support for not just the patient, but for the loved one as well. What other branch of medicine does that? Sees the patient as a family unit. You know, it takes care of people with serious illnesses. They focus, again, on physical, emotional, and spiritual. And, again, that go to your dermatologist and see if they focus on spiritual, emotional, and physical. Here's a cream. So we work with the patient and the caregiver as a team. We set up a plan of care. We have goals of care conversations. You know, I had a patient that was Amish that had been on dialysis for 9 years. Her daughter came to my support group and had come for years. She was crashing and burning, and she finally said, "Will you come talk to my mom?" Well, I was a little nervous going up to an Amish farm. You know, I didn't know what to expect. And I got in there, and her body language was like this. And I thought, "Ooh." Anyway, I focused on her daughter and how much her daughter loved her and wanted the best for her. And then she turned to her daughter and said, "Rachel, you be going to the barn now." And it made her daughter leave. And she said, "Okay, we're getting down to it now." She said, "How am I going to die?" 9 years on dialysis, and nobody told her what it would be like to die with end-stage renal. So we talked about that. And I said that, you know, when your kidneys don't function, basically it's very gentle, and that you'll sleep away because the toxins build up. So do everything that you want to do. Say goodbye to everybody. Forgive everybody. Say thank you. And do what you got to do. And when you're ready, stop dialysis. She took 3 months. She stopped dialysis. And she passed in 3 days. Completely at peace. Okay. Questions? I hope I covered it. I'm sorry. I ran over, didn't I? I apologize. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Take a break, and then I'm sure Amy and Beth will be here for questions. I know it's Orthodox time.
Amy said it all.
Thank you so much. We're so thrilled to have you. And another quick and easy way, I'm going to put in a plug. Again, I love hospice in Central PA. I get those brown boxes on my front doorstep just about every day, it seems, to my wife's chagrin. But every time one lands there, instead of going to Amazon.com, I go to AmazonSmile.com, and Hospice of Central PA is registered with Amazon Smile, so I know some small portion of all the nonsense in the 400 theological books I order a week that I'll never read goes to these good people. So consider
that.
Thank you so much, ladies.
I'm glad we have this recorded. Is it okay if we share this on our website and everything else? I know that within my vocation, when I have a hospice involved, I'm so thankful. And I always make sure to thank the hospice workers. Before I was a priest, I was I managed retirement homes. And I know that having hospice involved changed the whole complexion of someone's dying process. Instead of having at least the way it was in Oregon, if someone didn't have an anticipated death, the paramedics had to come out, the police had to come out. They were stressed and were not very sensitive to the fact that someone had just passed away. And the whole atmosphere changed when someone from hospice was involved, because it was an anticipated death, and it changed the whole atmosphere of that. And so I'm a major advocate for hospice. I was so glad you guys were coming here tonight. And just, you know, we're thankful for the work that you do. And I know that that the work that you do is good for people's deaths. We actually pray in our church for a Christian ending to our life, painless, blameless, peaceful, and for a good defense before the judgment seat of Christ. And so this is something that's at the forefront of our prayer almost every time we get together as church. So we're thankful for the work that you do, and we hope that God will bless you in it, okay? So let's stand, and we'll offer a closing prayer. It is truly meet to bless you, O Theotokos, ever pure, most blessed, and the Mother of our God, more honorable than the cherubim, more glorious beyond compare than the seraphim. Without defilement, you gave birth to God, the Word. True Theotokos, we magnify you. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Amen. Glory to Jesus Christ.
Glory to Jesus forever.